know who the slave is. And in today's first reading, you're given a glimpse of these three guys, and I always feel sorry for the reader when these readings come up, because you always have to say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego? I don't know. However you say it, you just have to go on and on and on. And then there's Nebuchadnezzar, satraps, all these words, and these are long readings. But this comes from the book of Daniel, and Daniel was written about 100 years before the birth of Christ, but it's situated during the time of the Babylonian exile. So the Jews have been conquered, defeated, and they've been sent into exile. And these three men and Daniel have been trained specifically for the purpose of counseling the king. And it's a slight insult, you know, like you lose your home, you lose your land, and then you're forced to advise the guy who's ruined your culture's history. But that's the way it works. But what I really love about this story is Nebuchadnezzar sets up false worship, and he tells them, worship the idols that I've set up. And then he gets upset when the three of them, I'll just say the three of them don't do as they are commanded. And what I love about it is that he gets upset and tells them, now I'm giving you a choice, die or worship. And he's like, no need for a trial, man, throw us in. Like, it's amazing. No need for a trial, don't waste your time, just throw us in. And they have this notion that there will be a deliverance, but it's by no means expected. The Israelites have had several encounters of the righteous not being saved, because they have yet, at this point, not quite fully developed a belief in eternal life yet. This is a very late development in Judaism's history. But they're sitting there and they're like, it's better to be honest and true before God than to die at your hands. Now here's the thing. We become slaves when somebody is able to dangle a carrot in front of us and then say, you will do as I ask because you want the carrot. Now, in many people's history, very often the carrot is, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to destroy you. I will kill your family. And then sometimes, as I hinted at yesterday, the carrot is just comfortability. We want to be able to feel as if, okay, I know what my life is. I know what my purpose is. It's pretty clear. But in both of those scenarios, people become slaves. And the people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they reveal they are not slaves. That even if they are servants of the king, they are not his slaves. Because this and this are their own. Now, of course, sadly, our own culture, in the name of freedom, is turning people into slaves. For self-determination, to be able to say, I'm going to enjoy my life on my own terms, people have functionally made themselves into slaves. And that is profoundly tragic. Because the devil is incredibly good at putting a carrot in front of people and then saying, if you don't do this, I'm going to make your life really scary and bad. And Jesus points this out to his interlocutors, if you want to put it that way, in today's gospel. I've also been stating it, that we have these miracles, and then Jesus works a miracle, and then the teaching that happens afterward explains the context of the miracle. So as I mentioned as well, the multiplication of the loaves and the crossing of the sea indicate two things, that Jesus is now a new Moses. He is liberating us from slavery, bringing us into a new land, and on two levels, helping us cross a dangerous sea, because he walks across the water, but also the walking across the water symbolizes the new wandering in the wilderness. The Jewish people are not fond of water. It symbolizes death and scariness. They're not a seafaring people. They're farmers. And so for him to walk on the sea is his way of saying, I'm in charge. That even the forces of chaos have no power over me. And so as we wander through the chaos, I will still be your guide. But now we're getting into a new phase. The next miracle that Jesus will perform is the curing of the man born blind. That would have been a Sunday reading 2 weeks ago, but I chose not to do it. But in a different part of the liturgical year, the healing of the man born blind, the really long reading, would have been on a Sunday a little while ago. And what happens in that story is obviously a man is born blind, and then a question comes up, who sinned? Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he suffers this fate? And Jesus' answer is, no man sinned, but this man's fate is as it is, so that the glory of God will be revealed in him. Very gradually, the man born blind, eventually Jesus heals the man born blind by doing something slightly gross, which is spitting on the ground, picking up a bunch of the dirt, and then putting it all over the guy's eyes. Maybe he's been living such a brutal life for such a long time. There's no recorded, like, what are you doing? This is gross. But that's what Jesus does. And in John's gospel, what that means is that as Adam was formed in the dust of the earth and then God breathed life into him, what Jesus is doing is reforming him according to his original pattern. God is restructuring humanity from its very core, from a condition that he was born with. He didn't choose it. There is a defect in it, but it is not moral. It's just the way things are. And as Jesus heals him, eventually it becomes revealed that this is a man who sees, and the scribes and Pharisees do not. And the whole thing goes where the man who was on the bottom is now on top, and the men who were on the top are now on the bottom. Those who say they see do not see, and then those who were blind have now been given the gift of sight. Now, the reason why this miracle is really important is because of what Jesus says in today's gospel. It's like a preamble, it's like a prologue. Those who sin are slaves to sin. It's brutal. But why are we so comfortable with it? Just like the man born blind, it's all we know. We've been born with this presupposition that slavery is acceptable. And we act like slaves. We will defend our master against the people who are trying to set us free. And Jesus gradually reveals who their father is. It's not God. It's not Abraham. It's the devil. That he is a father of lies and a murderer from the beginning. And this gospel sequence goes up and ramps up and ramps up and ramps up. And Jesus says to them, before Abraham and Moses were, I am. We'll get this fairly shortly from now. So what he's ramping up is to help us see is that even though we cannot see our condition, this is the truth of it. And that the truth will set us free. That when Jesus tells us, don't sin, he's not manipulating us. He's trying to free us. But if any one of us knows slavery, and we probably, none of us, were actually slaves in our lifetime, and it's a really interesting thing that as our culture has gone farther and farther from God, slavery has not decreased, it has increased. Sex slavery in particular is a horrible thing. And it is horribly on the increase when we no longer view a person as valuable in themselves, but only for what they can give us. But we know that from the perspective of our own hearts, one of the dangers of being a slave is that a person could easily manipulate us into thinking that we should be free. You can see any umpteen movies where a guy is trying to start a slave rebellion. I haven't actually seen the Spartacus movie, but I'm just going to take a wild guess as to how it all functions. It's way too old for me, and I don't get those old movies. Yeah. Anything before 1980, I just can't figure out. So you have this moment where if you were to be able to say to a slave, so say you're a slave, and I'm saying be free, and I'm not the slave, who suffers the penalty if the rebellion doesn't work? She does. If she participates in the uprising, then she's dead. Because her master will not only torture her, but her family, her friends, and everyone around her. And now we can understand why, even though God comes to set us free, why we're still so terrified of him. What will happen to everything in my life if I give this over to him? Will my former slave master be really upset? I will make you a very solemn promise. Yes, he will. He will be very, very angry. But that's a good sign. That is, in fact, a very good sign. There's a lovely little quote about St. Francis, where the demons spent all their time tormenting him, and they just left the village on its own because, of course, the town was already in their hands. They had to go after him. But another way in which we can envisage this whole transformation of heart and mind is I chose this morning's opening hymn. It comes from a guy named Blessed John Henry Newman. And he was a theologian in England around the 1800s, and a very, very prominent one in England. And he started developing these principles for what the true church happens to be. And of course, he was absolutely convinced that that was the Anglican Communion. And he wrote about it, he talked about ancient apostolicity, blah, blah, blah. And he went through all of these grand principles. And he was convinced, too, that the Roman church, called them the Romans, the Roman church was, let's just say, slightly anti-Christ-like. He was not exactly subtle in his criticisms of the Roman church. And then he goes to Rome one day. And he also has a health crisis at the exact same time. And he found himself strangely attracted to all these peculiar Romans and Italians, because the English and Italians are like oil and water. They don't get each other very well. So he goes to Italy, he worships with them, he prays in the back of the church, and he's like, I like these guys more than I should. And then eventually, in a near-death experience, he eventually recovers. He leaves Rome, and he writes this song, the one we sung this morning. Lead kindly light amid the encircling gloom, lead thou me on. It's an amazing little hymn, but I love to choose and see my path, but now lead thou me on. I love the garish day, and in spite of fears, Pride ruled my will, remember not past years. Hopefully I got that right. He has this realization in himself that God is tempting him, that God is wooing him. And it was not an easy thing for him to go through the transformation of realizing that the church that he saw as Antichrist was in fact the body of Christ. To be very patient. And so he had this whole humbling experience where he had to undergo this interior transformation. And then even after he became a Catholic, and a very prominent one at that, the Catholics still treated him like dirt because he was a dirty Anglican. He had a patience. He had a skill to truly see past the veil of tears and to get at God. Because he knew that his only freedom was to be a child, to be a son of such a father. And no matter who would hate him for it, or in what ways they would reject him, it's definitely worth it.